Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Ed Borens of Garcia Street Books. I'm very happy now to welcome Juan Mejia Botero. He is a filmmaker, and his new documentary is called Uprooted. It's screening this Friday at 7 o'clock at the CCA in Santa Fe. Screening is open to the public. And it's part of a weekend workshop sponsored by NALIP, which is the National Association of Latino Independent Producers. It's called Doing Your Doc. It's about teaching people to make their documentaries. Welcome, Juan, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So, Uprooted, it's a documentary focusing on a displaced family from the Pacific coast of Colombia, displaced because of the political violence that's been happening for many decades in that country. And probably not a lot of people in the United States know about the very significant Afro-Colombian population that has a long history, a rich set of cultures and traditions and music and all sorts of things. How did you come across this story?
Yeah, you know, I've been working for over, you know, close to 9 years now with the Association for Displaced Afro-Colombians. I became very interested, you know, when I moved back to Bogota, and I began to see all these kind of makeshift refugee shelters that would pop up in different parks, city parks and plazas of displaced people. You know, when displacement really, really increased, which was in the mid-1990s, and I started noticing that a lot of these people, a disproportionate amount of these people, were Afro-Colombians, Black Colombians from the Pacific, you know, and coming from the warm lands or the hot lands of the Pacific coast to a very, you know, a cold weather and also cold in other ways and racist city like Bogota, it just felt like, you know, it was a pretty bad situation, you know, on top of just the displacement. And I began working with this Association for Displaced Afro-Colombians, AFRODES. And after, you know, a few years of working with them, I started visiting some of the different displaced communities throughout the Pacific. And I met this family in one of these refugee shelters. And the idea came up of actually making a film geared more towards an international audience to kind of bring attention and you know, humanize a little bit or give a human face to this population, which is often left as a, you know, as a statistic or a number.
The family that you follow in this movie is headed by a mother named Noris, who had a farm, a 62-acre farm. They were pretty much self-sufficient. What was their life like on the Pacific coast before they were displaced, and what was that culture like?
Right, you know, that's very interesting. I think it's a really great question because, and you know, the Colombians, we are the first guilty of these. We have this perception that these displaced people, you know, because they're Black and they're in a situation of displacement and they're refugees, we have this in our imaginary, these are people that were always poor and were always suffering, and now they're just suffering more. When in reality, a lot of these people made a good living back in the Pacific in agriculture, and, you know, the Pacific coast itself is a region that has been neglected by the government, and if you look at the social indexes, you know, on infant mortality or life expectancy or education or health, they are below the national average, well below. But the communities themselves edged up a pretty good living in the sense that you know, they cultivated enough to feed large families without a problem, and enough of a surplus of other crops that they could sell to buy whatever else they needed and send their kids to schools in the nearby cities. You know, so if you ask them, you know, and this comes up again and again and again, what life was like before as compared to what life is like now, you know, it's a world of difference, and the nostalgia jumps up very quickly as these people remember how they lived before, you know, a life that was, you know, a very dignified existence, where they could educate their kids. You know, they all speak about how, you know, when they first were displaced, their children had never experienced hunger, and, you know, for the first time, they were. So, you know, it was by far a very dignified life before displacement.
And really all along the west coast of, well, the east coast too, of South America, but particularly, for example, in the Andes. I remember when I lived in Peru for a bit, and there was a whole world of Afro-Peruvian people who had been brought to Peru as slaves, and they just couldn't really make it in the highlands because the altitude was so high, and they ended up on the coasts, and a very rich and wonderful culture formed there.
Yeah, in Colombia, it's definitely the case. Most of the Afro-Colombians that inhabit the Pacific coast of Colombia came as slaves, right? But most of them came directly to the Pacific coast because there was gold there. So Colombia didn't have a very large plantation economy like Brazil, for example, or some of the Caribbean countries. But it did have a lot of mining in the Pacific, and a lot of the slaves were there, mining there. And all these communities were then formed by runaway slaves or slaves that were able to buy their own freedom and settled in these dispersed communities along the estuaries of the coast. And yeah, it was a locus of you know, this black culture, which, you know, mixed a lot of their African heritage with, you know, new cultures that they bumped into in the Americas, you know, including the indigenous population and the Spanish. So yeah, so the music is definitely has strong roots with Africa. So do many of the religious practices, etc. So it is very, very rich and, very rich culture.
So this family that you follow, when they left and she and her children left very quickly, why did they have to leave and what happened to the land they left behind?
Right. So displacement, you know, in Colombia is a very complex phenomenon. You know, you have an official version which is simply that displacement is a sad consequence of the violence between the extreme right and the extreme left in Colombia, and where the government comes in to try to take care of these displaced people. When you start digging in a little deeper, you realize that, as in many cases of displacement, not only in Latin America but also in Asia and in Africa, behind the violence, right, which might be the immediate culprit of the displacement, behind this violence, there's strong economic interest. There's a big struggle for territory and resources, right? So it becomes much more complex than simply conflict-induced displacement. That is what other people call development-induced displacement. And sometimes trying to draw a difference between these two is really very difficult. There isn't really a clear line between them in many cases. And I think that that's definitely the case in Colombia. Norris's case had to do specifically with death threats from guerrilla groups because of one of her sons decided to join the military, which they perceived as some sort of treason and came after Norris. But, you know, that's her specific and individual case. In many other cases, you know, the actual immediate culprit for the displacement isn't, you know, the real underlying cause. You know, the real underlying cause, in my opinion, has much more to do with territory that's very rich in natural resources, that is very, very good for agro-industry. In the case of the Pacifica, the African palm, for instance, would be one of the things that is really popping up there. But there's also, you know, all sorts of other crops that agro-industry wants to really push in the Pacific coast. So I think that's the real cause underneath the displacement. And the land, that's usually what ends up happening to a lot of the land. In Norris's case, a lot of the timber that she had there was then exploited by the armed groups, and all these lands become either, you know, part of the agro-industrial frontier or part of the sustenance of these armed groups, either through exploiting them for timber or whatnot, or by making them into illicit crops, you know, coca plantations or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, Norris, when she talks about her land, she said, you know, that they're using it for their own purposes. And, of course, with these endless conflicts between guerrillas and paramilitaries and so on, and everybody's trying to arm themselves and everybody's trying to find something, some way to make money, taking people's land away and growing cash crops is one way to do it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, especially if that is also part of, you know, the government policy. You know, if your government's economic plan is one that, you know, bets all its chips on agro-industry and not on a peasant economy, then it's a lot easier for these abuses to happen, you know, because the government is happy to see agro-industry taking over the Pacific coast and you know, all these export crops being cultivated as opposed to the smaller, you know, more traditional crops that peasants cultivate in the area.
We're talking to Juan Mejia Botero about his film Uprooted. So when this family that you're following was moved, when they had to get out of there so quickly, where did they go? What was the refugee place like where they landed?
Yeah, you know, usually that's a little bit of a journey, you know, so they, from their, you know, their smaller communities, they end up going to the nearest, you know, bigger township, and then from there to one of the bigger cities where apparently there'll be more possibilities for employment usually. This particular family ends up in Quibdó, which is the capital city of Chocó, one of the bigger departments of the Pacific coast. And they initially end up in the city Coliseum, which a group of displaced family actually takes over. They occupy the Coliseum in protest to kind of call attention to the fact that there's this big displaced population coming into the city, and the mayor was refusing to admit that they were even there. So they take over the Coliseum, and they actually end up living in the Coliseum for over 2 years. You know, over, you know, something like 600 families. It was, you know, horrible conditions, you know, no running water. Until finally, with the Spanish Red Cross, you know, gives them some aid to build this refugee camp outside of the city of Quibdó. And the way that the government works things out is the government says, okay, this land is not yours. We won't, you know, we know you don't have money, so we won't sell it to you, but we'll sell it to you in exchange for your labor. So the government doesn't even, you know, give them the land, but sells it to them for their labor. So they actually, it was the same people that were displaced in the Colosseum that actually built these quote-unquote temporary shelters to move into until the government builds them, you know, permanent housing. And, you know, that was back in 2002. And there's all these refugee shelters are still occupied. You know, so they weren't really that temporary to begin with.
Watching the film, it's sad, and it's certainly educational for those of us who didn't even really know about that situation in the first place. They are not, when you think about how much worse it could be, they're surviving. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge loss. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes of the film is, what would it mean to do more than survive, and where is that going to happen? And one of her sons is a teenage boy who is a soccer player who is, during the film, trying to get away to Bogota to go to a soccer academy. And it's sort of like, in a way, it sort of reminded me of, in the United States, you know, the talented black athlete who finds his way out of a tough situation in urban America, mm-hmm. to try to make a living or get a scholarship or whatever through sports.
Yeah, you know, and the parallels are, I think, are very important in terms of race and the way that race operates in these various countries. You know, I think that the spaces for black people in Colombia to actually have some upward mobility are very, very limited. And that becomes especially evident once they're displaced. You know, these are people that, you know, at least the rural black population were people that are used to to edge a life in agriculture, and they get to the cities and then realize that, you know, their spaces for them to even just find a job are quite limited. You know, most black displaced women in the cities end up working either as domestic workers or cleaning ladies or, you know, some sex workers, and men either in construction or in security. You know, and that says a lot about the racism and the racial stereotypes that operate, and sports is definitely also one of them. You know, black youth also see it just the way that they do in the States, you know, as one of their only, you know, real opportunities to make it out of poverty is through, you know, through sports. Even though if you actually look at the reality of it, the percentage that actually makes it is so low, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like there's hundreds of thousands of jobs as a professional athlete.
Exactly.
There's a handful of jobs. So since you've made this film, how has it been received? Where have you taken it? Have you had some success in really spreading this story around outside of Colombia?
You know what? It actually is funny because it actually has done much better outside of Colombia. And it has had some success in the festival circuit in the U.S. and has played in a number of cities in the U.S. It has actually played in film festivals in Africa, in Ghana, and done well there. It has played in a couple of film festivals in Europe and will play in a refugee film festival in England pretty soon as well. So it has actually been received fairly well in the U.S. We're looking at options with public television as well. Sadly, though, it has not had the same type of reception in Colombia, and I think that has to do with the fact that I think Colombians, we have this perception that we already know the story of displacement, and we already understand it, and we are actually a little bit tired of it. It is kind of like a little stone in your shoe or something that becomes kind of a bother that you don't really want to be reminded of. So much, you know it's there. Yes, the displaced people are there. I see them at traffic lights. I see some stories that is still happening on the news. But I don't need to be reminded of this so much, and I especially don't need to really understand it any further. At least that's how I felt that it's been received in Colombia itself, which you know saddens me quite a bit.
Tell us more about the work of AfroDes, the Association for Displaced Afro-Colombians.
Yeah, AfroDes is a wonderful organization. It was started in the late 1990s by displaced Black Colombians, and it started. It's very, very small, very few resources, and it started as a very small organization only in Bogota. But it has been so efficient at reaching out to displaced people and informing them of their rights and helping organize them and helping now really put pressure on the government to pay special attention to the Black displaced population and give them the culturally appropriate aid and culturally appropriate response to their situation, and that they've actually grown quite a bit. AfroDes now has offices in a number of cities where Black displaced populations end up, and it has become I think one of the leading Black organizations in Colombia, and still working hard today. And I think I think their work is actually very, very admirable. You can actually look it up at www.afrodes.org, and then there's a lot of information about them there.
AfroDes is spelled AFRODES. If people want to look it up, I'm going to put it on my website as well.
Right.
Is there any chance of people like Noris and her family actually getting their land back?
That's a very good question, and it's a very difficult question. Colombia went through a pretty incredible land reform after a new constitution in 1991. Black communities organized around this constitution, and after a lot of lobbying and organizing and protesting, were able to push through a law called Law 70, which was passed in 1993, where these communities were then able to prove ancestral ties to the land and actually get communal titles to their land. Because up to there, all the lands where these Black communities lived was considered empty land. So the government could grant permits to, timber companies or mining companies to this land, regardless of the communities that lived there. After this law was passed in 1993, these communities began a very long and difficult titling process. But a lot of them in the late 90s began to get titles to their land, coincidentally, and maybe not so coincidentally, really, it was precisely then that displacement really hit the Pacific Coast. So actually today, well over 70% of the people, the communities that had titles to this land, over 70% of them are no longer in the land. But they still do have the titles. So what the Black social movement in Colombia hopes is that, they can really now begin to push for the government to actually make their titles valid and give them the appropriate security to move back to their land. The problem right now is there's no guarantees. You know, the armed actors are still there. The very aggressive economic interests in the region are still there, oftentimes backed by these armed actors, you know, in alliance with them. So it would be very difficult for the communities to attempt a return to their land until certain guarantees are met, and so far they haven't been. And it's difficult to imagine how they will until, you know, the conflict subsides in the area and until the government's economic plan for the region also changes and also allows a space for peasant farming and more traditional peasant agricultural within the current economic model.
Juan Mejia Botero's documentary is called Uprooted, and it's screening this coming Friday at 7 o'clock at the CCA in Santa Fe. And it's part of a weekend workshop sponsored by NALIP, the National Association of Latino Independent Producers. For more information about this workshop, which people can still sign up for, they can go to NALIP.org, NALIP.org. And you can also check out the Santa Fe, the Center for Contemporary Arts at ccasantafe.org. And one more website for the film Uprooted itself, you can go to uprootedthemovie.org. Juan Mejia Botero, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Chola. I appreciate it.
I'm happy now to welcome Edward Borens. He is the co-owner of Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate your inviting me to join you today.
Well, we are here on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of your tenure at Garcia Street Books, you and your wife, Eva Borens. You've owned the store for 10 years. And I thought it would be a wonderful time to talk about where the book world is at this point in history. It's certainly changing a lot because of electronic books, and we want to talk about all of that. How did you get into the book-selling business in the first place?
Oh, I started as an academic. I'm an historian by training, and I wrote history textbooks. And so I drifted into the book-selling world that way, as well as I had a friend who owned an art gallery in Toronto. I'm from Toronto, Canada. And he came up with the idea of opening an art bookstore. So we opened the bookstore together. It was the first art bookstore in Canada. And then that store grew into a general bookstore next door. And then Eva, my partner, in business, co-owner of Garcia Street Books, and my partner in life, will be celebrating our 44th wedding anniversary on June 5th. Ava was involved right from the beginning. Ava came up with the idea of opening a museum shop as well, which was really way ahead of its time. So we had three stores side by side, and we remained with this business associate for several years, and then in 1979, Ava and I went off on our own and opened Edwards Books and Art in Toronto, downtown Toronto. And that that operation grew into, at one point actually, we were as many as close to 20 stores because we provided outlets for a junior departmental store. And we had a large warehouse operation, wholesale operation as well, but essentially it was five large stores and one of Canada's largest independent bookstore chains.
And all of that happened in Canada. How did you find yourself coming to Santa Fe, New Mexico?
We visited Santa Fe in 1990. A teacher that had retired to Santa Fe in 1975 and had a profound influence on my life, used to come to visit us in Toronto, and it took us 15 years to visit him in Santa Fe, and we fell in love with it. And we thought, if we're ever free of our three children and our business, we would consider living in Santa Fe. And by fall of 1997, we were free of our children and our bookstores. Our children always say, usually it's the children who leave the parents, and this time it was the parents who abandoned the children, but they're old enough to be abandoned. We drove out here, and we never went back.
And so Garcia Street Books, which has been around for quite a while, I mean, it was here when I moved here 20 years ago, was for sale.
Everything's for sale in Santa Fe. We didn't realize it was for sale. That was 1997. We purchased it in May 2000. Ava had worked for another bookstore operation in the interim.
And so in those 10 years, the book business has undergone huge changes, as has the business of print journalism, which is a whole other story. But we have suddenly, comparatively speaking, suddenly the, first of all, rise of the internet and Amazon and the ability to buy books online and get them delivered very quickly and so on. And now we have electronic books and Kindle and the other electronic media for reading books. How does that affect your business?
Well, we are really in the midst of a revolution that is more profound than the development of the Gutenberg press. The reason I say it's more profound and it means it's much more widespread is because when the Gutenberg press was developed or invented, it was only a very small group of people who could afford to read. Reading was a luxury. Very few people were even literate, and books were very expensive. Now, books will become accessible to almost everybody throughout the world, globally, because books can also, and we'll see this in the future, it's going to happen to a much greater extent, a book can be read on a cell phone as well, and most people have cell phones. So we have iPads, we have Kindle, we have a new product in Canada that's been developed called Kobo. It hasn't hit the market yet here. Will have a profound effect. It's hard for me to predict. Ava and I are in a very fortunate position. The book business was really very good to us in Canada. We were able to support our three children, send them to the best schools and colleges. And here, I mean, here in Santa Fe, it has really been wonderful. That was the best decision we ever made, buying Garcia Street Books 10 years ago. And as a bookseller, I mean, Santa Fe is the only place I would want to be a bookseller in North America.
It's crazy. I mean, I used to live in Boston, and there was a little pamphlet when I lived there called A Guide to the Bookstores of Harvard Square. And there were travel bookstores and mystery bookstores and general interest bookstores, all of them independent. There's not a single one left in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in Harvard Square. And in Santa Fe, New Mexico, we have several independent locally owned bookstores.
Well, actually, I was reading the Santa Fe Reporter's annual manual. There are 20 independent bookstores. They vary in size, but what a great city. It's able to still support 20 great bookstores. When we came here in 1990, the first visit, we were just blown away. It was a busman's holiday because next to Ann Arbor, Michigan, Santa Fe had more bookstores per capita than any other city in the United States. So probably was one of the reasons we kept coming back, visiting bookstores in Santa Fe, and then ultimately moving here. But it's been wonderful being a bookseller here because our customers are so loyal. The demographic in Santa Fe is still excellent for an independent bookseller. How the future will develop, it's very hard to predict. If this demographic continues...
Do you mean the demographic being retired people, people who grew up with books in their hands?
People who grew up with books in their hands, exactly. I have some serious concerns about the younger generation. The kids are in school because they're so plugged into their various electronic equipment. I'm wondering whether they'll want to hold a book in their hands. It's a very interesting time. I mean, the rate of sales of books versus rate of sales of books that can be read on various readers is rapidly changing. And the electronic books are taking over. Now I'm talking about the nation. In Santa Fe, I mean, it's good. We have a good life here.
You're still selling books.
We're still selling books, and we're profitable. I think it looks good for the foreseeable future. But I'm just talking to our son before we I came over here. He's a lawyer in Vancouver and a partner in a national law firm, a Canadian firm. I'm glad he's a lawyer. Our youngest son...
Well, not a bookseller.
And not a bookseller, exactly. Our youngest son is an artist, and that's not exactly an easy profession, but actually he's doing very well. Some of his work is in the National Gallery of Canada, and I believe he's the youngest artist whose work is there, so he can support himself. Whether I'd want him to be an artist or a bookseller, I think he's made a better choice, to tell you the truth. And our daughter is on her third career. She was a publisher, a very successful career as a publisher, and she was editor of largest circulation magazine in Canada, women's magazine, Chatelaine magazine. And now she's embarking on her PhD at the University of Toronto at age 40 with three children. All of them worked in the bookstore from the time they could see over the counter. They grew up with books. But I would be concerned, perhaps if they moved here and wanted to continue our business. But even then, you know, I'm not sure what the future will be. The foreseeable future, I'm optimistic. Books are not going to disappear. I mean, there's always the panic, the alarm cries when the Book of the Month Club was formed in, I think it was the 30s. There was a retail book business. They felt this is the end. Everybody's going to buy through the Book of the Month Club. When television was came into rapid use, people felt this is the end of the movie industry. Well, we can see it's never the end.
Movies and books are still with us.
Exactly, and books will always be with us in a certain form, in certain types of books. Art books, I think, and that's one of the reasons I think we're thriving, because we have such a great selection of art books.
And children's books, too. I mean, little kids want pop-up books and colorful books and things that have a texture and a smell and all that kind of thing.
They do, but also I see our three grandchildren, well, the youngest is only one, but the 3 and the 5-year-old, yes, they certainly have books. But they love their electronic gadgets, so and you know, remember, their mother is a publisher, grew up with books, so perhaps they've had a bit more encouragement than most children. I think it'll be difficult for art books to be used electronically. But the technology probably will develop. But at the main point, I mean, what's going to happen in people's homes? When people go into the library, a Kindle will be on the shelf. I mean, there's nothing better than being able to pick up an art book or a book that's on your shelf. It's sort of like a friend, and, you know, you revisit it. It's quite different than sort of... flipping through your Kindle or whatever.
Well, you know, there's a remarkably similar thing with music and DJing. When I started DJing Latin music and salsa music is more than 10 years ago, I think, around 10 years ago, and all you had was your CDs, and now everybody's got everything on MP3 on their computer, and they DJ that way. But I sort of, the way I used to DJ was, oh, that CD with the pink cover, track 3 is really good. You know, you
exactly.
have developed a relationship with the objects.
Exactly. That's well put. You develop a relationship with the books. You mark the book. You turn down a page. You flip through it. And I don't think it's the same thing. But we'll see. I mean, bookstores will be around, but who's going to own the bookstores? I think that'll be an interesting question because it's a wonderful business. I mean, when I decided not to join the family tradition of being lawyers, that was the best decision I could have made. And I mean, you meet the most exciting people. We have the events. The authors are fascinating.
You have wonderful authors at Garcia Street.
We love doing that. So in some ways, it's almost like a social activity. And there probably will be people in the future who have the means who want to own a bookstore as a hobby and really won't be terribly concerned whether it's a viable business. And then, just like many struggling artists and writers, people who want to take a vow of poverty, and they might want to open bookstores also. So it'll be interesting to see.
We're talking to Edward Borens, co-owner of Garcia Street Books, which is, they're celebrating their 10th anniversary at Garcia Street this weekend. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But how have Amazon and electronic books and so on affected your business? I mean, do you have any way of measuring that or having an intuition about that?
Yes. I can see that it's affecting the bestseller type, bestseller aspect of the business.
Meaning you don't sell as many bestsellers.
Right. We're doing better than ever with our sale books because it's a very specific talent in order to buy these books, and Ava is the buyer, and this is a business she's been doing now for almost 40 years, and she was known as the queen of, the technical term is remainders. These are the bargain books. You can't really access those electronically. So that business is actually way up. And, the art book business, we're doing well because you have to have a certain knowledge to be able to really know what art books to stock. Ava and I got into the book business through this friend who had the art gallery and wanted to open the bookstore, and art was our, and still is, our passion. I remember when we didn't have any furniture when we were first married and lived in Montreal, we bought art books. We'd sit and look at the art books together.
Sitting
and actually
on the floor.
Flip, really, yeah. And then with a bridge table that somebody gave us for our wedding anniversary, for our wedding. It was wonderful. We just we love art. It still is our passion. So,
what is the art of art book buying? In other words, how do you know? I mean, in the Southwest, is it very heavily Georgia O'Keeffe and Southwestern artists, for example?
Yes, but just give you an anecdote. There's new book out on Robert Motherwell, the Open series, and I came into the store and I said, Dave, you're displaying this so prominently, do you think you're going to be able to sell this? Has very esoteric poetry that goes with it, and Motherwell is certainly a well-known artist, but he's not like Picasso in terms of how well-known. Well, that book has been flying out of the store. It's a $65 book. It's an intuitive thing. I mean, Ava's in the store a lot more than I am. She knows her customers. I think that's one of the secrets. And she knows what to buy. Also, over the years, I mean, the wonderful thing about bookselling, we've learned so much from our customers. You obviously don't know every book you have or or every book that's out there, but you pick up. I mean, people come in, they place a special order for a book that we don't have, and that's another thing I have to mention. It is such a pleasure to be a bookseller in the United States. The system's about to change in Canada, but special orders used to be torture for us. Now, if we get a special, we can turn a special order around often in 2 days, 2-3 days a week most, unless it's a very obscure book. So the special order comes in, we look at it, and we say, hey, this would be good to stock. So you're constantly learning from your customers, especially in Santa Fe. You know, I can't stop praising the level and just our customers in general. They're so loyal and so knowledgeable. It's really a pleasure.
You know, the way you describe it, it's such a personal and intuitive and relational business that one wonders how big chains can make it work at all, because that's not their business model.
Well, for us, it's like giving a party every day, actually. That's the way I look at it. It's not working for the chains. The chains are being hit as hard or even harder than the independents. Borders was on the verge of going out of business, and then they managed to be refinanced to the tune of $700,000. Their stock has picked up significantly, but we'll see. But they are really hurting, and Barnes & Noble are hurting also, perhaps to a lesser extent. The companies that are really damaging the chains are the Costcos, the price clubs. Mm. They bring in a very, very limited title range and discount them so deeply, even deeper than our two national chains can do. And that's having a big effect on those businesses. But you're right. You come to an independent bookstore, you're going to have knowledgeable staff. I mean, one of the reasons it's such a pleasure being the owner of Garcia Street Books, we have the best staff. Again, it's an intuitive thing. They know they can match the book with the customer. Whereas if you walk into the national chains, you are greeted with blank stares.
Well, so if you go to Garcia Street Books and say, I'm looking for something for my sister who is a ballet dancer turned hospice nurse, they'll say, oh, I've got just the book for you.
Well, often customers will come in and they'll say, I'm looking for, and even before they can get the title of the book out, our staff and Ava know the customer so well, they'll tell the customer the title of the book that customer is looking for.
That's crazy. What are your greatest sellers?
Our greatest sellers, now you mean? Generally?
Generally, I mean, what is, I mean, this is interesting to hear that this Motherwell book is flying off the shelves. What are the perennial favorites?
There it's a lot of the Southwest books. We do very well with Hampton Sides books. And the new one's doing well, too. Actually, we're doing a benefit at Santa Fe Prep for the prep.
Yeah, we're going to have Hampton Sides on next week.
Oh, great. Good. So a lot of the regional authors. It's sort of quirky because we don't have that many runaway titles. It's a little niche. If you come into the store and you look at the table of paperbacks in front of the counter, they're Ava's picks, and they sort of sell equally. So it's hard for me to say what is running out of the store.
So there's basically a variety of things.
It's a wide variety, and that's where the buying skill comes in. And that's a major difference between the independent and the national chain. because the national chain doesn't have a real breadth of titles, even though the stores are big. They don't have the range of relevant titles that customers want.
Yeah, they might have a pyramid of 90 books
exactly.
same book.
Right, right. And we don't do that. I have a rule, you know, our space is so limited that we just can only display a book in one space unless it's something very exceptional.
Now, you and Ava have been doing this your entire married life together, and if
virtually.
if you don't mind my asking, I mean, it's a nice role model that the two of you have of an equal partnership both in your business and in life.
Very much so. It was fun when we started in Toronto. I don't know why, but we used to go, and the business has changed so much, we'd have to physically go on buying trips. So we'd go to New York, and we'd be buying the bargain books. That was always one of our trademarks, our specials. And we'd argue three, they would say five, and we'd compromise maybe with four. And then we got smart very early on and divided our responsibilities. So Ava has always done the buying and the selling. She's the person you see in the store far more frequently. And I'm more behind the scenes. In Toronto, it was a big business. I mean, I had to spend a lot of time just doing things like talking to accountants and lawyers and running it. But I did the events in Toronto as well. And here I've learned to stay out of our back stock room because it's so small and I get in the way. So we defined our roles quite early on, and I think that's been the secret to our success, and also a very strong mutual respect that we have for each other. I mean, Ava is just been the most wonderful partner in life and in business, and also mother of three children. We worked so hard when we were in Toronto, and we really we did it on our own, and it was just through sheer hard work and perseverance, and we just
and some good instincts to boot.
Yes, I guess so. Some good,
Now, you are having this weekend, it's your and Ava's 10th anniversary as owners of Garcia Street Books, and so Saturday from 9:30 in the morning till 6 in the evening, you are having, what, a little celebration, a sale? What's going on at the store?
Well, it's going to be a massive store-wide sale. Check out the our ad in the Pasatiempo this Friday, page 13. We'll give the details. And it's just one day only. We just want to thank everybody by giving this sale, and we'll be on hand from beginning to end to greet our customers and to thank them for having enabled us to thrive and prosper for 10 years. It was certainly the best decision we made to buy Garcia Street Books.
And when people talk about shopping local, this is one example of the kind of store that is so very locally based and oriented towards serving this community.
Absolutely. We try to support local authors with events, and then we do some national, international authors. I'm very proud of three benefits we did in the past few months. Margaret Atwood for Wild Earth Guardians, and then Greg Mortensen. That was probably the highlight of my almost 40 years of book selling. Greg Mortensen was just wonderful, and we donated a portion of the proceeds to Pennies for Peace. And then Eve Ensler, we filled the Lensic. That was in February. That was a last-minute thing. It came together amazingly well, and high school students performed, and we raised a lot of money again for V-Day.
Well, Ed Borns, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mary Charlotte, and thanks for all your support over our 10 years.
My pleasure. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the monthly New Orleans Hour.